Right.
How are you, Eric?
I'm good. Been freaking busy, but...
What the heck's going on? Looks like you haven't shaved in a while either. Are you just coding all the time? What's going on?
Yeah. I'm trying to kind of, you know, be cheap. I'm Dutch, you know, so I'm kind of trying to shave, you know, not more than once a week.
I'm on the same way. Yeah. Hey, it's great to have you back. It's been a while because I know you've been really busy. We have a very special guest today. People on Channel 9 have seen him before and in certain contexts, but what's going on?
Well, we're here in building 10, I think, yes. And look at this kind of amount of monitors here. Like, it looks like a trading room or something. And then here we have golf. And in the address book it says orange. Is that because of your glasses?
No, or it's a long-running joke from when I first started off here.
And so I have an orange drink.
Perfect.
Yeah, all in style.
Yeah, and you're orange from the light.
Yep.
So, what is the orange deal, man?
When I first came to Microsoft, nobody knew how to pronounce my name. So I had it as my signature, rhymes with stove. And, as you know, time goes on, you just want to change stuff up. And I had it as doesn't rhyme with glove. And then later on, as part of the Vista time frame, I think I had it as rhymes with Fred, which confused everybody. And then I eventually changed it to rhymes with orange because nothing in the English language rhymes with orange. And it's just kind of stuck.
Oh, well, probably we have some geek viewers that will say, well, wait, you know.
English language. We got to stick with the English language.
Exactly. Excellent.
So, yeah, I've just kind of taken on that persona. You know, the orange glass. Well, these are actually dual purpose because staring at a monitor all the time, the orange glasses shifts the blue spectrum out. It makes everything warmer, so it's a lot easier on my eyes.
Interesting.
Staring at a computer screen for 20 hours a day.
Is that what you do?
I don't sleep. I'm never roof.
Yeah, that's kind of what I heard. What's the story behind that?
I like being able to be a resource for people, you know, when they need it, right? And not everybody's workday ends when, you know, at 5 o'clock. So I deal with people that are not in our time zone. You know, they're in Europe, they're in Asia, wherever. So, you know, I like being available. People may know that I actually have my office phone. I don't actually have an office phone. There is no office phone in here. My address book number forwards to my cell phone. So I'm infinitely reachable pretty much at any point in time. I've been called up at 3 o'clock in the morning by various people. I answer. I will razz in.
So what is your job then?
I work in application compatibility. So I've been doing this for the past decade. And basically what I do is ensure that applications that, you know, any application that's ever been written practically works on the next version of Windows. So, you know, when things break, when things don't work, they go to me, the rest of my team, and we figure out, well, what caused it to break. Obviously something in Windows happened that caused the app to break, and we figure that out.
Oh yeah, so you're the guys that make Windows valuable because you know,
well,
that's what I love about Windows is that my old stuff still works.
Mm-hmm. We take it very seriously.
Yeah.
I mean, we're protecting consumer investment. You know, they don't just buy Windows; they feel good about it because of all of their applications. They invest in their applications, enterprise all the way to someone's grandma. You know, it doesn't really matter. We want to make sure that their investment is sound over years.
Mm-hmm. So and how, like, you know, like we like to drill down technically a little bit, you know, in these shows. So how, you know, how does it kind of work? So if I get a new version of Windows and maybe some APIs have changed, mm-hmm. how do you make sure that, you know, old applications that might rely on older APIs or maybe buggy things, mm-hmm. that they still run?
So we do that in a number of different ways. I mean, the simplest approach is always don't change the APIs. So,
tell that to developers.
Yeah.
Exactly. So, our job, and we've developed tools that actually ensure that APIs their contract is maintained.
Okay.
You know, so anything that's public, we make sure that they don't change. This goes not just for like parameters, which are kind of brain dead, but return values, error codes, everything. You know, we have to attempt to maintain that compatibility. That's, of course, a simple approach. The harder approach, and what I work on and a number of people across my team work on, is something called the Shim Engine.
Okay.
So this is a technology that's baked into the operating system where we can give applications their old behavior. We can make them have their buggy behavior. We can give them whatever it is that they depended on in the previous OS. So I don't know if you've noticed this, but if you right-click on any XE, go to Properties, and go to something called the Compatibility tab, we have different layers there that attempt to approximate certain environmental features of the previous OS that we knew that we changed, that we know that applications rely on. Like, the quintessential one is the Windows version. You know, everybody and their dog relies on trying to figure out what the Windows version is. There's about 30 different ways of coding it. There's maybe two ways of doing it right. And we handle the other 28 ways of how people do it wrong and try to fix them up. It's oddly very difficult to get a version check correct, such that you write it today and it will always work in the future.
Yes, yes. Often the most trivial things are the hardest to get
but
right.
But let me ask one quick question about that. I mean, get version EX.
Yep.
That's not rocket science.
Right, but how do you compare it?
Answer that.
So, as part of the OS, get version EX, mm-hmm. there are essentially four parts to it. There's the major, the minor, the revision, the build. Mm-hmm. There's the there's whether it's a client or server. You know, mm-hmm. the as part of the OS version structure.
Sure.
There's a number of different fields. So you can compare that as a binary value. You can compare that as a string value. You can compare that with a service pack level. So all of these comparisons, how do you know, like, as a dev when you're picking it up, what the correct version is? If you want to say, I want to ensure that I work on Windows XP and higher. Windows XP was version 5.1, okay? How do you compare that? How do you say that? Well, there's a number of ways. You could say, well, get version EX, major version is 5, minor version is 1, okay? You could say, well, it must be if the version, the major version is 5 or greater, then you have to then compare the minor version. Mm-hmm. So, but if you don't do that correctly, what happens when you get to something like Vista, where we changed to 6.0? Well, you could compare the major version as 5 or greater, and then when you do the minor version as 1 or greater, that's the wrong check. You'll fail because mm-hmm. now the minor version is 0.
Yep.
But in that case, the minor version doesn't really matter.
But
5.5 and greater. Period.
But that's not XP. So if you're running a if you're running an application that you've now targeted to Windows 2000, because in your compilation you can actually say NT version equals
crazy.
Yes, and then probably the you know, because people think that this is easy, this they will leave this to the junior programmers, and then they will get it wrong.
Yes.
Yes.
And then Gov will get a call at 3 o'clock in the morning from Germany.
Yeah. And also what I notice is that, you know, if a program doesn't run, the operating system kind of tells you, you know, kind of shall I check for you which version it is, so how do you do that?
So we have a number of heuristics there. We detect whether it's a setup, a legacy setup. We can tell, hey, you know, it was a short runtime, or you didn't complete, there, based on different pieces of information. We can then say, well, you had a UAC manifest, so we think that you know about Vista, but you don't have the application compatibility manifest, which we introduced in Windows 7. So we'll say, we think that you're a Vista-capable app, so we'll give you the Vista version. And hope to goodness that everything works. But it's all really a Hail Mary. You know, when apps don't work off the bat, it means we've never seen it. It means that we haven't put in any kind of special mitigation, and we haven't fixed the OS at all in order to mitigate it. So it's really a Hail Mary attempt. If it works, great. If it doesn't, call support.
So now let's kind of, you know, take a little bit step back and look at your own compatibility. So how did you kind of, you know, enter the field of computer science? How did you, you know, get...
let's see, I was thrust into the field of computer science. Okay. I don't have a degree in computer science.
Okay.
I have 3 degrees in chemistry, physics, and molecular genetics. So I'm from Canada. Mm. I'd been working with computers ever since I was a kid. You know, I had an Apple Lisa, I had TI machines, tearing them apart, writing code. I had my own company, and then I worked my way through school, and then eventually kind of ended up here. I realized that computers and software, and actually problem solving, that's really what I want to do. I like to solve problems. Is kind of how cool. I ended up here.
So and so it's kind of interesting that you have 3 degrees,
none of which are computer
and none of which are computer science. So do you kind of ever miss like physics or like chemistry?
I still use it. Okay. Even I wouldn't necessarily say on a daily basis, but you know I use their foundation. It's the scientific method, right? I use the math, I use the concepts, the design, hypothesis. So I use that really heavily in my day-to-day work. Hmm. So I find it very valuable. Systems, you know, physics, chemistry, and biology is taking a look at every level of a system, from the lowest level to the highest level. So being able to integrate that into, you know, my daily job has been very, very helpful.
So and so I imagine that when you get a problem that you kind of, you know, you're applying the scientific method where you have a hypothesis and you're trying to falsify it and
exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, it, especially from what I do is, you know, debugging. You know, I spend literally all my time in the command line debugger. So it's very difficult to say with code that I don't own because all of this is third party assembly with no source or symbols or anything. It's very difficult to say exactly what went wrong. Well, what you can do is say, what can I eliminate?
Yep.
You know, I can binary search this and at least get down to something and prove it or disprove it. You know, oh, that didn't pan out. Well, let me hit another one. But, you know, for me anyways, it takes a large amount of system understanding because you can't just say, or you can't just know about one tiny part of the OS. You kind of have to know about all parts of the OS because it can fail at any point, anywhere from the loader, you know, to display, you know, and anything can happen.
Well, if it was a composable system, Eric. Anyway.
Well, even that, you know, in order to kind of find errors, usually they're not composable. Mm. But like. When you're saying, you know, you have to kind of, you know, debug third-party code, so can you disassemble stuff in your mind? Or do you use tools for that? Or do you can you read kind of the binary? And
I dream assembly.
Okay.
I cannot tell you the number of times where I've been working on a problem for a couple of days, and I will figure it out while sleeping. You know, and I'll come back the next day and I'll try it out and I'll replay the events. And it's like, that was it. You know, that was the actual thing. So I let it mull over in my head, you know, reading error codes. I can tell you error codes as they're, you know, coming up in a stack. So it's where I'm comfortable. It's absolutely where I'm comfortable.
Yeah. And so when you say you play things back in your mind, events back and so on, so... For me, it often helps. You mentioned that you never sleep, but when I have a tough problem, I kind of often induce, you know, like artificial sleep deprivation. And then when I'm in this kind of weird state where, you know, between sleeping and dreaming and being awake, and then often, you know, suddenly you see the solutions to the kind of most difficult problems. Is that something that you have as well, or?
I don't know if I've put myself into a sleep-deprived state on purpose.
But you're always in a sleep.
But, yeah, oftentimes I'll come up with a solution in unconventional ways. You know, especially if I've been working on a problem for a long time, I'll really just want to cut it out, you know, do something completely different.
Yep.
And, you know, subconsciously, you're still working on the problem.
Yes, go for a walk, take a shower, or whatever. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah, I like to go hiking.
Yep.
So, the fresh air definitely helps.
And so, you said, you know, you can dream in assembly, so can you also recognize, like, you know, which compiler generated the code and things like that? Because probably there are certain patterns that you recognize.
I can definitely detect the VS compiler as opposed to, say, the Delphi compiler or GCC. they have their own quirks.
And with the kind of, you know, issues that you find, is there like some like 80-20 rule? Is like, are they often in a particular area, or are they kind of, you know, all over the place? Are they always kind of different, or do you see?
It's kind of for the kind of problems that we see. It's kind of like the long tail. You know, you have very common problems that show up all the time. And they happen in the same apps over and over and over again. And then you have the interesting problems, like, oh, they messed up on their calling convention, and only by happenstance it worked, because the compiler saved off that register before returning. You know, but now we got a new drop of the compiler, we added a new flag, and they optimized it out a little bit, or they changed the function underneath, so, oh, we don't need to save this register anymore. So, yeah, those are really hard problems to find, you know, to truly understand.
Yeah, so and one of the things that, you know, for security, right now we are kind of loading and DLLs at different, you know, addresses and so on. That must make your life harder or not, because now, you know, things might not be so repeatable or predictable anymore.
We have some tracing tools that help that. For address-based layout randomization, ASLR, what you're talking about. For the most part, it doesn't tend to matter that much. You know, if they're dealing with hard-coded addresses, that's pretty stupid for one thing. But usually larger problems are around applications that don't handle greater than 4 gig address space.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so things that can be found or that we can diagnose, we use tools to help us out, like application verifier. You know, we can give it a whole bunch of different tests to at least rule out possibilities. And it usually helps us for our regression testing as well. You know, with app verifier, if it failed on, you know, the current OS, highly likely that it failed on the previous OS as well. And it just happened to work because, oh, guess what? Nobody was using greater than 4 gig memory at the time, you know. So we definitely notice problems like that, especially trying to make really, really old applications work now. It's kind of like, well, technically they always failed, but we never had the hardware in order to make them show that they failed.
Yes, exactly, yeah.
So, yeah, and our job is to, like, say, okay, great, you know, they fail now. How do we make them keep working?
So you mentioned tools. So, you know, whenever, so do you kind of, how does that work? So do you kind of, you know, whenever you see a new issue, do you kind of feed that back into the tools to help, you know, to make it easier to find the problems the next time, or to kind of, you know, help your team?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, we have write-ups of issues, you know, really hairy issues. When we find an issue that is likely to affect other applications or other scenarios, you know, we'll fully document it. We'll add in the debug spew for a problem that isn't easily or going to be quickly fixed. We can write extensions that'll, you know, help analyze the problem quickly, especially if it takes a long time to debug.
That's interesting.
And so, how long have you been in this job? I mean,
over a decade.
Over a decade. So how many operating system versions is that? That's like, you know, I think.
So I was working on XP. So if you count all server releases, that would be XP 2003, the various 64-bit flavors, Vista, Win 7, and our next version.
And can I don't know, you know, if you can share these things or if you even know, but like, you know, there must also be like a long tail of programs that, you know, maybe people ran in Windows 3.1, but you know, as you know, time moves on, you know, more and more of these programs probably kind of, you know, die off. But you know, there must be a long tail of things that, you know, WordPerfect or I don't know, is old stuff that people are still using. Is there?
So we get telemetry. Okay, yeah. So we get information back.
Yeah.
We obviously have to go after the large apps,
yes,
you know, the
yeah.
ones that are heavily used,
yeah.
Just because that's our biggest bang for
yeah.
the buck. But what we also try to do is we don't just look at an application failure, right? We look at how can that affect any application that's doing something similar. So while we don't necessarily go after the long tail directly, we go after it by thinking that everything is a class issue and then going after it as if multiple thousands of applications are affected, so that we internalize the problem. So we say, this is bigger than just one app. And you know, by thinking of it in that sense, we go, well, that makes it important. Every issue is important. So we just have to spend the time and root cause it. After the actual root cause is figured out, you know, after the engineering work is done, then we get to make the decision. We get to make the call. Well, how do we fix it? Do we fix it? That's more of a political, you know, cost-benefit analysis. There are some things that we just cannot fix. Some things that we rely on the partners to help us fix, because you know, we don't own everything. We have the ecosystem, and the ecosystem does help us out.
And so another question in this kind of space is like, we sometimes kind of discontinue products or like, I think, didn't we just say that Microsoft Agents, you know, the kind of that yeah. we stuff. But what if an app kind of, you know, is relying on those? So how, you know, how does that work when you're moving forward?
So we have internally a very clear deprecation process, mm-hmm. and it's all data driven.
Okay.
So what we don't ever want to do is say, we're going to stop support on something or we're going to take something out knowing that people are depending on
okay.
it. So the first step is pretty much figure out who is using you. So we go, you know, component dev, it has, you know, they own a piece of code. If they're going to remove it or they're going to change it, they have to know who their consumers are.
Mm-hmm.
So that's our first step. So, you know, we do a ton of data gathering, we extrapolate. There are some things that, you know, many people are saying, well, that's really, really old. But it doesn't matter. It's heavily used.
Yep.
So you can't change it. Sorry. Deal with it. We'll figure out weird and interesting ways of extending. We can figure out ways of saying, well, we know that the engine that is doing this work is really old and fragile and whatever, and we have a new engine. Well, okay, how do we translate it? How do we move it to the new engine while not affecting the consumers of it? Yeah, I mean, you brought up the Microsoft Agent. That one is, you know, a case where no team is available to work on that code anymore. And there was not enough usage data to say that there's going to be a continuing investment in it. So from the data, we showed that there wasn't enough applications using it in order to further warrant investment, and such we deprecated it.
And I have fond memories of those because they always made great demos, you know, like getting one of those annoying kind of things on the screen and with beautiful voices. Yeah, that's that was the first when we did Comment Drop. That's, you know, that was our favorite example. So it was like, you know, it was like a sad day when I heard that they were gone. Yep. And so let's talk about a little bit kind of, you know, different thing about compatibility. So like file formats and things like that. Is that something that also falls into your work?
So file formats as in like the .exe format?
The .exe format, or maybe also kind of, you know, of various, like, you know, Office when they change their file formats. And there's many apps, right? Maybe, you know, they use .ini files, and now they use whatever config files. And so there's more to an app than just the executable, right? There's all the kind of, you know, extra stuff that it stores, maybe in the registry or in other places.
Yeah, so, I mean, we're definitely concerned about the entire application. You know, if an app... clearly for the OS, we're dealing with much lower level stuff.
Yes, yeah.
So, I mean, they're dealing with... We're not changing the INI file format, for example. That one is going to stay the same pretty much forever. There are certain things that we will never change. We will extend. We'll absolutely extend stuff. But we won't drop support for those types of things because it will affect too many applications. Yeah. If you're talking about, say, Office file formats, we unfortunately have no control over that, you know, if they want to change it. But Office's compatibility for their existing versions is really, really high bar. You know, they do an excellent job of maintaining compatibility.
I was just using that as an example where there's kind of an obvious kind of, you know, thing where there's the Office kind of executable, and then there's the kind of, you know, the objects on which the executable works. But right. You know, there's many other apps that have the same kind of thing. So
I mean, like COM objects.
Yes.
We absolutely maintain compatibility for that. We've kept around things that have, you know, been around since Windows 3.1, even earlier in a lot of cases. Or, you know, we've extended them. They've morphed underneath, but, you know, their interfaces stay the same.
Interesting. One question I would ask there is, you know, why isn't there some notion of lifespan for compatibility? You mentioned Windows 3.1, mm-hmm. right? Now... So just out of curiosity, that's what I'm asking. Why would you go to the trouble mm-hmm. of supporting something that is so ancient and outdated? Mm-hmm. Because from your, I'm assuming that from your telemetry, mm-hmm. you must be seeing that people are still calling into this API.
Right. So but, it existed in 3.1, and then we said, well, it's got to exist in Win 95 because, you know, they're still using 3.1 apps. And then, well... people said, hey, the API is available, I'll code Win9X apps. And then we moved to 98, mm-hmm. and then ME, and it's like, oh, well, we still want those apps, they're still heavily used. And then that same mentality just keeps going forward. As long as people are using it, and as long as we haven't produced something better and have moved people off of it.
Are people still using that app in Vista and 7?
Sure.
They are? Oh, you have telemetry to show that?
Yeah, you can still run...
Wild.
You can still run 3.1 apps in...
But, I mean, you're actually seeing that as the case in the real world.
Sure.
It's
remarkable.
I'm using a really old app from, I think, pre-95,
Wow, man.
I mean,
okay.
we still support 16-bit. So, I mean, there's really... until people tell us, and, you know, the ecosystem has to tell us that they don't care about this anymore, why shouldn't we support it?
Because one could argue that it, and this will be a fun conversation to have, because one could argue that it slows down the rate at which discoveries happen, or the rate at which innovations can be implemented and shipped. So, for example, if I wanted to make radical changes to an operating system to turn it into something that maybe it needs to be, but I can't because, I have to support, you know, 20 years of this one thing, and in my current model and the way that we're designing this thing, mm-hmm. it just can't work. Okay. Even with application virtualization, mm-hmm. it's too much of a waste of investment.
Okay.
Other companies can just say, too bad, bye-bye.
Mm-hmm.
But we won't do that. And I'm not trying to make this into anything about what's really going on, everybody out there. It's just a question. Compatibility is incredibly interesting. Very important, but also, isn't it a two-edged sword?
It is absolutely a double-edged sword, but we have to think about it, right? Can everybody switch overnight? No. There are individuals, there are small companies, there are enterprises that their entire lives are built around, you know, their investment, their software, and their way that they do business. We can't expect them to say, well... you know, we want you to buy our new operating system, but we also want to have you throw away millions of dollars of investment so you can try out this new thing, where we still don't have third parties building on it.
Mm-hmm.
I deal with those types of conversations very, very frequently.
I'm sure.
So our general response to that is, well, okay, let's figure out a way that you can at least lay the groundwork for what you want to do. Because there's always a way of saying, you know, let's bake the code, let's create the code. Maybe we don't turn it on by default. Let's get people to move to it. Let's build up that ecosystem so that people want to use it. And they use the new things. Mm-hmm. And once we've hit a critical mass and we say, you know what, we've now, over the period of years, and yes, it's a slow-moving machine, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. Once we move them over, you can start thinking about, well, okay, we don't have to support this old paradigm anymore. It's just like 16-bit on 32-bit OS, or, you know, 32-bit on 64. We have to support the old thing in order to help people move along. Mm-hmm. But we can't just cut them off. We can't just say, you know, yes, we have something new. The old stuff is gone. Please code to it. They're going to say, well, okay, so you have this new thing. Company B has this new thing. Why? What's stopping me from just saying, you know, go to company B? If you're going to make me do something new, why do I want your something new versus somebody else's something new? I want to be able to maintain my investment in what I had and move to the new thing at my own pace.
Fair enough.
So Charles mentioned virtualization. And you mentioned that you're using this shim layer. Mm-hmm. Where is kind of the boundary when you kind of say, okay, let's just virtualize the whole kind of, you know, operating system? I think, like, you know, where you kind of have a VM that runs XP, and if you want to run old stuff, you run it kind of, you know, inside a VM. So where is that boundary?
The VM argument is very interesting, right? It's a very large hammer to solve a very particular problem. There's a lot of aspects to a VM that everybody has to be aware of. It's an entire operating system. It takes a huge amount of memory, disk space,
but
servicing.
Isn't that all free these days? Memory, disk space.
Yeah.
You'd think so. I mean, on a singular home machine, perhaps. In a business environment, maybe not. It also doesn't actually solve the problem. It's like, sure, they bought the new operating system, but they're still running the old operating system. So it has none of the actual benefits that the new one does. But, you're able to run your apps, and it's certainly a position that we take for transition. You know, if an enterprise, and that's really where virtualization mm-hmm. comes in, is for the enterprise, if they absolutely want to move to the new OS and they cannot get rid of whatever it is that doesn't work on the new OS, we definitely advocate some mitigation, whether that's virtualization, whether it's shims, in order to help them move forward. But virtualization, you know, they can't stick with it forever. It's not a great mm-hmm. long-term solution. Mm-hmm. But it's, again, that stepping stone. Now, in terms of what we do in the OS to say, you know, just go ahead and virtualize it, that's pretty much the last step. You know, that's the last choice that we can have. Because it's not a great option for the customer. They really just want to drop in the OS and just have it work. And, you know, that's what I'm here to do, is help them do that. We don't want to have deployment blockers. That's our worst possible case, you know. It's bad for our reputation, you know, user perception isn't good. What we really just want to say is, hey, get our new OS. It has new features. It'll work.
And do people, like, say that I'm you know, developing a product or and I want to change things, do people then go to your team, you know, beforehand to kind of prevent problems?
Absolutely. Our team is designed to do that. We give consultations, you know, we do design reviews, we tell them, you know, don't do it this way, do it this way, or, you know, here's how you can mitigate a bunch of potential problems. You know, it's definitely a higher upfront investment, but in the long term, it's actually a smaller investment. You know, we can tell them how to factor things differently, how to light up. We really like the light up and opt-in kind of aspects, where, you know, we don't affect anybody doing legacy stuff, but all new apps being written, you know, anybody writing new stuff can take full advantage of the new stuff, and they don't even have to worry about the old stuff. So we like those kinds of things. We like giving, we want developers to have the incentive, right? We don't want to beat them over the head saying, here, use our new stuff. We want them to say, hey, I want to use your new stuff. What do I got to do it? You know, make it really simple for them.
Yeah, and Charles, to kind of, you know, come back to your point, yeah. I think it's very important as more and more things, you know, become digital, that we, you know, preserve them. I mean, we can still read, you know, things that were written on, you know, sheepskin that is 3,000 years old or 5,000 years old, however.
Sure.
But, you know, we cannot, you know, read software or things that are maybe, you know, 40 years old or 30 years old. So I think that's a big concern. So I think for that reason, I think it's extremely important that we put, you know, this is not just a luxury or
say it in Dutch. It's okay.
But I think it's essential to, you know, to preserve these things. You don't want to, you know, these things to get lost.
Agreed.
Absolutely. It's a huge investment. Yes. You know, it is not just the money investment. It's the intangibility of how a developer feels and how a user feels about our OS. Like that kind of goodwill. That's priceless.
I still have a program that I wrote in college on a floppy disk, like the really floppy ones.
Yes.
In Turbo Pascal. That is the coolest screensaver I've ever seen. Mm-hmm. I will say that, and I'm not ashamed of saying it. I think it was really, really cool. It was built on solving a pretty complicated mathematics problem. And each solution that comes through the iteration, you know, it's like the classical, the fractal kind of thing, right?
Yeah.
But it wasn't a fractal. It was something different. It was something stranger.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just this really wild, cool, colored thing. I can't run it anymore, man. Number one, it won't run on the operating system I run today. Mm-hmm. I don't have a floppy drive, do you?
I do.
You have one?
You have one
at home?
No, I think my wife made me throw them away.
So that was sort of the only point I was trying to get there, with, you know, being a little bit sarcastic. I mean, was, you know, the hardware goes away too, right?
Yeah. Yes, although
try and find a 3.5-inch floppy drive nowadays.
Yeah.
Yes. Although the interesting thing is that you see now a lot of emulators for kind of, you know, old computers, and, you know, people somehow get the ROMs or the software kind of, you know, upload it, and then, you know, you can still kind of virtually run these things. So, yes.
Very, very interesting.
Maybe there's somewhere service where you can send your floppy disk and, you know, have it uploaded.
Yes. I'd love to see what that code was, because when you're young, you can't fail. And you just, you know what I mean? I have no idea what I did. I just remember it was cool.
Yeah, I still have my first compiler that I wrote. This is like in a printout, you know, like with in the matrix printer. And,
nice.
So I could, you know, in theory, kind of type it in or scan it in.
Cool. Yeah. So coming back, another question for you, Gov. Now, one of the things people need to know about Gov, everyone that I know that's G-O-V is Gov, but I'm going to call you Gov because that's your name. And now I get it. Doesn't rhyme with glove, so it can't be Gov.
Yes.
I mean, it has to be Gov. So here's my question.
Yeah. So this guy, I messed it up in the beginning completely as well, yeah.
Oh, see, I'll answer to anything. That's just it.
So I subscribe to various aliases, as we all do as Microsoft developers and evangelists and whatnot. And Gov is all over the Visual C++ Special Interest Group, or the C++ language, and especially the Win32 programming issues alias. And he, I think, replies more than anybody else at the company. It's amazing.
Somebody
asks a question, Gov says, come on, give me a little more details, right? Or here's what you probably need to think about. It's very impressive.
Oh, so, I'm just, you know, just one person out of many, many that really want to help people on those aliases.
But at least you're nice, because there's a certain person that I won't name who's got to be the most curmudgeon-y person in the world.
You're not talking about me?
No.
Wait, I thought I had that title.
Well, there's even one that I think beats you, man. You know who I'm talking about.
Yeah.
He won't come on Channel 9.
So what is talk about, like, you know, C++, what is your favorite language? Besides assembly, of course.
I mean, it's definitely native code. Okay. You know, I will write and manage code. I prefer native code. I can read and understand pretty much any program flow. Right, it's all pretty basic. But yeah, I live in native code. I live in low level C, actually, most of the time, dealing with the operating system. So much of it is still in C. So yeah, that's just, you know, where I'm most comfortable. It's easiest for me to understand. Managed code is a lot of abstraction. You know, there's a lot of underlying things that I like to know about. You know, I don't want to just be able to call a method and have everything done for me, because I have to figure out when things go wrong. So in the end, even in managed code, I have to go back to the native code, because it's usually at that boundary where something goes wrong. The nice thing about managed code is, of course, it's all self-contained, you know, so when you write to it, it's portable across multiple operating systems. But it is, again, harder when you have to figure out, well, what is actually happening underneath it.
But isn't that what keeps you sane, or like normal people like me, keeps us sane, that we can forget about certain things?
Sure.
If you know, if you would have to keep all those details in your head and always kind of think what can go wrong, life would be, you know, pretty tough. And if you go to the elevator and every time you kind of, you know, have to look down, if there's not a hole, you know, it would be like a little bit paranoid. So, but
well, call me paranoid.
Yes, yeah, you're coding paranoid.
I am a huge proponent of understanding design. You know, understanding how things work. So even as a managed code developer, I think that you have to understand what is, at least at a higher level, understand what is happening underneath you. You know, as a component developer, I think that you should understand who is using you and how you use the things below you, like where you exist in the layer. Because it's very difficult to say, I only think about where I am and I don't think about anything else. Because if you're making changes, you're going to be affecting people above you, and, you know, if people are making changes underneath you, they're going to be affecting you.
But isn't that getting harder and harder? Like in the olden days, you know, when people would build, you know, a program, the first thing they would do is to build their own hardware, build an operating system, define a language, and then build the app. And then, but now, like if you think about the cloud, you know, it runs somewhere. You know, I don't even know, it's some web role, and you know, I don't even know what hardware is underneath. So, aren't we kind of raising the level of abstraction to a point where, you know, you really have no clue what's going on underneath?
And that's absolutely true. So for the external developer, yes, we've made it much simpler for them. But even as an external developer...
Well, or maybe harder, right? Because if something goes wrong, now there's no way you can...
Right.
Yeah.
So that's just it. We have to, or they have to be aware that, sure, I'm running in the cloud or I'm running on a server somewhere, but, you know, what do I depend on? Or, like, how do they even figure out what their dependencies
yes.
are?
Yeah.
And that's a hard question without understanding some of the more basics. Like, can you replicate your cloud environment internally, you know, so that you can at least take a look and figure out what you depend on? You know, are you performant enough to scale across, you know, multiple locations? How do you even know that? Have you designed it? You know, so that's why I'm a big proponent of design, because you have to think about the potential problems before you can solve or attack any individual problem. Interesting.
But let me push on this a little bit more, right?
Sure.
Because like, even you know, in on a you know, if you're on a client machine, you know, like how do you know? You have to know your particular processor to know what, you know, your cache behavior is, how big your cache. So there's so many kind of moving parts.
Especially in the Windows environment.
Yes, and you know, how can you know, keep those all in your head, and then not only kind of for one, but for so many?
That's why I don't sleep.
That's why you don't sleep.
No, it is very difficult. Yeah. Like for me in particular, it's very difficult to keep everything straight, and I don't even pretend to keep everything straight. I am continually relearning things that I forgot, you know, months, years ago. But, you know, for an application developer, the easiest way to not have to worry about all those idiosyncratic behaviors of Windows is by not taking a dependency on them, you know, making it as simple as possible while succeeding in solving your problem, but you can't make it simple without understanding what the true problems are. Which is why pretty much every response to interesting questions I get is, what's your scenario? Like, have you actually thought about the problem that you're trying to solve, as opposed to just saying, you know, I want to do X. Well, why do you want to do X?
Yes, and that is something that's quite interesting, because often people forget what the real problem was that they're trying to solve.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if this is the answer, you know, what is the question? Mm. Yes.
Absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, a lot of people are dealing with inherited code, you know, inherited systems. Yeah. So they want to make changes, but they don't really know what they're going to break by poking something, right? Because our systems are tightly integrated. You know, different parts interact with other different parts, and a tiny change somewhere could destabilize the whole thing. So before making a change, you have to understand what is currently there. That's a difficult problem.
Absolutely.
And do you think there's a difference when you have source code available or only binaries, or is that like for? I've spoken to people who say, oh, you know, it's like, as you know, what you said is like, I can dream in code, so you know, it doesn't really matter whether I have, you know, if you give me the binaries, I'm happy. Is that
for my point of view, the binaries are really all that matter.
Yeah.
You know, but I need to be able to see what it's doing in a running system.
Okay.
You know, and it's oftentimes very difficult. You can have processes that run generated code on the fly.
Yes.
You know, so it could actually change from hardware to hardware.
Yeah.
And it's like, okay, well, that's still a solvable problem, because now you just run it on different hardware and figure out what's common and you know, what's different about it. So, again, that's applying, you know, the scientific method is trying it out multiple different places and, you know, see what's different about them. Start adding, changing variables, you know, multi-proc, single-proc systems. We had a ton of issues going from single-proc to multi-proc, you know, and they're really interesting, especially taking a look at now really old apps, you know, stuff that we don't test. We never tested during the single to multi-phase. Mm-hmm. It's like, wow, they're broken in a way I've never seen before. How do we fix that now?
Yeah, so that's an interesting. How do you fix things that were, you know, not thread safe because maybe they were not running kind of really concurrently, but now when you have many cores, you know, they are really running concurrently.
Mm-hmm. And how they didn't even know about running concurrently.
Exactly. So
they were multi-threaded, but not concurrency aware.
So now when you want to kind of keep them running, how do you do that? How do you isolate them or kind of, you know, shim them?
So we actually have a shim, and conceptually this makes sense, in that if it was a multi-threaded, single-proc-aware application, well, it should run perfectly fine on a single-proc, and it shouldn't care if there's multiple procs on the system. It wasn't designed for that anyways. So we tell the application, you run on a single-proc.
Okay.
So in a multi-proc system, we just say, you only get to see one proc. And we lie to it, essentially.
Mm.
And yeah, that 99.9% of the time, that solves the problem. Because it doesn't need multiproc.
Yeah, so sometimes it's good, Charles, to kind of lie a little bit, you know, to kind of...
I guess.
Yes.
So,
yeah.
Which actually...
Those are apps that don't need to take advantage of the new stuff. We want to give it the old stuff.
I was pretty serious, because that's kind of, you know, what you're trying to do, right? You're trying to make it, you know, pretend that the app is kind of, you know, in a different context.
Yes.
And you know, isolate it from reality in some sense.
Yep.
Yeah.
But I mean, and that's exactly what application virtualization is, AppVert. Remember AppVert? All of us sitting in this room, when we launch on our IT-controlled, spyware-filled, just kidding, I'm just joking, on the computers that we're on that are run by Microsoft IT,
mm-hmm.
when you double-click on a PDF, for example, mm-hmm. it launches application virtualization, which streams an application instance, and you're running, it's the PDF viewer, mm-hmm. but it really isn't. It's not installed on your machine.
Right.
It's running in a different file system underneath NTFS.
Mm-hmm.
And the only reason I'm saying this is because we're lying to the application. In some sense, but we give it all of its DLLs that it needs, but we don't give it the whole OS.
But
so why don't we do more with that?
It doesn't care about the whole OS. We're giving it the environment that it expects.
Yes. So, but I mean, why don't you do more of that for your compatibility work?
We do that in cases where it's possible, but that doesn't actually solve the compatibility problem. So with the app V, we give it the DLLs of the operating system that it's currently working on, mm-hmm. right? So it's still, when we're talking about Windows 7, for example, it's still running Windows 7 DLLs. It's still interfacing with the Windows 7 kernel. It doesn't solve the compatibility problem because if the app works on Windows 7, mm-hmm. it will work in the virtualized environment as well. If it fails on Windows 7, it'll fail in the virtualized environment as well. Hmm. Because of the same DLLs, the boundary has just been more defined.
But can't you virtualize? You know, we talked about virtualization before, right? But there you virtualize the whole OS. But can't you, like, you know, virtualize that application and give it the old DLLs and kind of make it kind of, you know, believe that it runs, you know, it's in the old environment?
We can. I mean, it is technically possible to do. It's just a much higher overhead. Mm-hmm. You know, because now what we're saying is we have to carry around old DLLs that we would have to service that in the act of servicing may still pose a compatibility problem. It is generally simpler to say, to take the stance of, rather than having to do this on a per-app basis, we just make the OS compatible. Because now you're not having to target a particular application. You just say, hey, guess what? It doesn't matter what application that you're running. It just works. Like that is our bottom line, though. That's what we want to do. That's our goal. That's our you know, number one goal, is to say it works. Mm-hmm. The virtualization isn't a compatibility fixer. It's a isolation feature. It's mm-hmm. a security type feature. Mm-hmm. You know, sandboxes. That's really all it is. It's a sandbox. And for something like PDFs, it's a good place where the code can run without affecting the rest of the system, which is a different approach than saying the rest of the system not affecting the application.
Sure.
Which is what compatibility is. Virtualization is the app not affecting the rest of the system.
Which is cool. I mean, like, for example, I've run Visual Studio 2008 on my machine using App V, mm-hmm. and I don't have 2008 installed on my machine. It just runs. But you have to wait for the initial streaming of all the bits, and then it builds the... I mean, I thought it was a really, really interesting technology. I don't know what happened to John Sheehan. I don't think he works here anymore, but he was the guy behind that. Used to work for us. I think it's a great technology.
It is. It's an absolutely wonderful technology. It just doesn't solve the compatibility problem.
Got it. Yeah. But you know everything.
Oh, you support everything,
dude.
I will never claim to know everything. If I work with pretty much the smartest people on the planet. Mm. You know, if I'm constantly learning from them. Everybody that I work with, I'm always learning from them. That is, you know, once I stop learning, you might as well just kill me.
Oh, man.
I like that, because once you stop learning, you might as well be dead. That's my motto, right? Because you're not, you know, growing anymore. And so, yeah.
Very cool. So let's ask, what else can we...
Well, I keep kind of looking at these screens. So, you don't have to show what's on there. But is there kind of a system behind? You know, because usually when people have multiple screens, they have, you know, have some system that they're using.
Good.
So talking about learning. So,
So, I mean, generally, you know, I'm always on mail, so I have mail on here. I have internet, code, bugs, and what you'll notice as it comes up, because I was TS'd into it earlier. But soon as DWM starts up for me. I run Media Center, and I've got a TV feed, because the way that I work is I like having white noise behind me, preferably on shows that I've seen, you know, dozens and dozens of times. Mm. It just the way that I think it. I don't know. Some people use music. Every now and again, I'll use music, but I like having the TV in the background.
And so, what is your favorite show?
Oh, probably Stargate. Yeah, Stargate, Star Trek, sci-fi, comedies, really cheesy comedies.
Mm. Excellent, man. So you're running 4 monitors. Looks like you have how many? So there's your box down there.
My beast dev machine.
Yes, that is like a beast of a machine.
I built it. That's my machine.
Okay. And
when I leave, I take that with me.
Nice. So what's the specs?
That is an 8-way with 16 gig of RAM with a RAID 5 system in it with 3 terabytes. So I can pump out a build rather quickly. I deal with, you know, gigabit size dumps. I bought this gigabit switch, which, you know, I've got gigabit tap in my office, so pulling down new builds takes very little time. You know, this is my main test machine. I can lay down a build on this and get up and running in about 10 minutes.
Nice. Nice.
But yeah, that's my beefy box.
That's awesome. And you're still writing code?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. You use Visual Studio or you use...
or Notepad or... Yeah.
I use Ultra Edit, actually.
Okay.
Ultra Edit?
Yeah. I prefer having the light text on dark background. Mm. I get really bad migraines. Oh. So, interesting feature. I don't know if you've ever seen it, but this is really cool. And I will use this every now and again. Well, not that. But that.
Ah, yeah, Brian Beckman just uses the same.
Color inversion.
Yes.
DWM color inversion.
Yes, yeah.
Is very sweet for coding with Visual Studio or, you know, basically anything. Mm. Obviously, this inverted my editor, which I've already inverted.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it looks normal for me.
And what's the control to do that?
It's the built-in magnifier tool.
Got it.
And the option is turn on color inversion.
Okay.
But yeah.
So cool. What is your favorite, what is your favorite feature in Windows, and what is your least favorite feature in Windows from, you know, based on your experience with, you know, compatibility?
Great question.
Yeah.
I remember my number one draw for Windows, because I wasn't here prior to XP, was remote desktop.
Mm-hmm.
That was, for me, the killer feature of XP. To this day, it's one of the best features.
I 100% agree with you. I love it.
I love remote desktop. If I have to spring forward into the future, Hyper-V, hardware virtualization. That has saved me countless days of work, you know, months of work if you aggregate it all out. Being able to boot from a VHD, my testing environments are so simple. Being able to roll back, consolidate, you know, just keep things completely separate. I can keep my data on a separate drive, my VHDs on another drive. It just makes life so much simpler. Multimon is, of course, you know, been around forever. Mm-hmm. I use it heavily. let's see, what other cool features? I actually like UAC, you know. I like working in a standard user environment. Like the security of it. I think that's, you know, pushed developers more in the past 6 years. Mm-hmm. As a single technology, as a single thing.
Mm-hmm.
Larger than most others. You know, that was a completely different way of thinking about things. It's really helped our security, you know, our baseline security of what can be exploited on the system. You know, out of the gate. You know, you install a Windows build now, it's like, you know, you don't have to worry. I remember pre-XPSP2, before we turned on the firewall by default, you couldn't hook up to a network tap. Mm-hmm. It was impossible. You couldn't do it.
Mm-hmm.
You had to patch it up with a separate CD or floppies, God knows back then, with the latest updates. But, you know, a lot of our on-default technology, the built-in firewall, Windows Defender built into the system, is we keep adding additional value as each OS goes on, and it just keeps getting better.
Cool.
All right.
Well,
so
he didn't say his least favorite.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
There was a double-sided question.
My least.
Yeah. So, which one is the most? You know.
Well, maybe we should.
Yeah. You know, my least favorite aspect, and there are a bunch of us that over time are trying to work through this problem, is MaxPath.
Ah.
Yes.
That is my most hated aspect of the operating system to date. But it is not entirely our fault. We have a very, very, very long road ahead of trying to get out of this sinking boat that we are in.
With regard to MaxPath for file names and directory and locations and stuff.
Yep. The 260 MaxPath is...
When was that? Let me ask you this. When was that const defined?
Oh,
or
right.
When was that number defined? Talking about compatibility and supporting the
old days. What, VMS? Pre-VMS? It's a holdover from a very, very, very long time ago. Yeah.
And what is the problem? If you let's just for sake of argument, really quickly, because I know you guys both have to work. What do I do for a living? Yeah. What is MaxPath? So you said certain length.
Yeah.
Got it. It's an integer. Okay. Mm-hmm. What would you break if you just made the integer an order of magnitude larger? What would break?
You'd break
everything. Okay.
You'd break absolutely.
I'm trying to bring it down to brass tacks. It's not a simple problem.
No.
It's a very complicated problem.
It's a complicated problem. I mean, if there was no other software on the face of the earth except for Windows and stuff that got produced out of, you know, Redmond and Canvas, if nothing else existed, we'd be fine. We'd bump that up, no problem. But the problem is when you're taking path values and you're shuttling it across different processes, different components within the same process, they don't know what max path, or they know, unfortunately, too well what max path is, and they have implicit dependencies on it being 260 because that's what their buffer size was, that's what they compiled to.
Got it.
You know, you go one character beyond that. We've seen this in bugs over the years. You just change it by one character, and you have weird corruption issues. And let me tell you, tracking down heap corruptions are not fun.
True story.
Yep.
And you couldn't fix that with a shim?
Nah, you can fix almost anything with a shim, but it's, at that point, you're shimming the world. You know, and you're not doing anybody any favors, and you're still not able to properly interop, you know.
Excellent. I think that's the title. So, Gov, Shimming the World, Dreaming in Assembly.
Yes. Yes. Well, thanks a lot.
Oh, thank you.
That was really good. I'm going to try those orange glasses, because I'm also kind of sitting in front of the screen for... maybe not 20 hours a day, but...
These are the Oakleys.
Okay.
You go to LensCrafters, and the tint is called persimmon, something with a P. It's
persimmon.
Persimmon, there you go. It's like 30% tint, but it's absolutely fabulous. It's so much easier to see, and the amount of blue shift that it cuts out is amazing. Nighttime is actually really nice, because... You know, it kind of lightens up dusk. It just makes everything warmer.
And they're awesome. X-ray as well.
Oh, no. But I think we're going to see a lot of developers wearing these now.
If they were X-ray, let's just say that I wouldn't be working in an office all day.
Fair enough. Right on, guys.
All right. Hey, thanks a lot.
Hey, Eric, thanks for coming back,
good,
bro.
Okay.
And great to talk to you, Gov.
You too. I appreciate it.
We'll see you again.